danger is stealing in as relapse hums above the din. It's hard to know if this will be the day.
Hello and welcome to episode 260 of the Thinking Poker Podcast from the fabulous Gold Coast Hotel and Casino in Las Vegas, Nevada. I am Andrew Brokus, pleased to be here in person with Nate Mavis and Carlos Welch. Hi guys, it's so good to see you.
You too.
Yeah.
Nate, I'm glad you were able to make it out here. It seemed like that was a nail-biter.
Literally woke up the morning of, not completely sure I'd be able to make it out here, but everything fell in my favor, and I'm out here for 3 days, trying to pack a lot into it.
That's right. You were, what, 37 minutes from off the plane to cards in hand?
34. Yeah.
34.
34 to being seated at a table for, there's a long all-in, whatever. I didn't actually get cards in my hand for a couple minutes after. And I made it a total of about 9 hands in my first 2 bullets, so.
So, yeah, this was Colossus, which you were close to max late registering.
Yep, that's so, right.
Understandable that not always easy to... you're going to get your chips in early.
Yes.
When you're only buying 10 big blinds.
That is right.
And by a strange coincidence, you and I actually ended up in the same seat. So I also fired 2 bullets in the Colossus, neither of which lasted terribly long. I busted. I went to go say hi to you. I decided to hang around until your break because it was coming up pretty soon. And the next thing I saw, you text me that you're in a seat. And I look over and it's the seat that I had just been in. And you're all in with Kings versus Ace-8. And that was the end of it. Yep.
That seat was not kind to the Thinking Poker Podcast.
I said that it busted the entirety of the Thinking Poker Podcast team, but I think Carlos belongs on the team, and he was wise enough not even to play the masochist.
Yeah, that's what I called it. I call this tournament the masochist, but it's hard to even say that in Nate's presence because he's so excited to play it, but everybody else is like just a chore to like just painfully go through multiple bullets, grinding a short stack all day, just trying to make it to day 2, but you know, Andrew kind of convinced me today that if you make it to day 2, it's great. It's just hard getting there.
Well, and even the day 1, I mean, the way I'm trying to look at this, and like my series is off to not like a profitable start, but like a reasonably good start.
Right.
So maybe I'm in like a better mood than, you know, yeah. Like some people, it's sort of the justifiable the moods that they're in.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like the poker itself is not very interesting in the classes. Like I would say maybe like once every 2 hours I did something where I was like, a less skilled player might not have done that thing.
Right.
And then, I mean, there's certain things that like really unskilled players are doing that I'm not doing, and there's a significant advantage there. But it's for the most part, it's not interesting poker-wise. But you know, there are a lot of interesting people who play the tournament. It's a very kind of fun, like precisely because there's not a lot of tough decisions. People are pretty relaxed and kind of like having a good time at the table. And there's a lot of fun players, not in the derogatory sense, but just like players actually having fun while playing poker. Yeah. So it's sort of a fun milieu, even though it's the poker itself is not compelling.
Okay, see, that's kind of the vibe that I have when I'm playing single table satellites. So, okay, that makes a big difference. Because when you say interesting people, that could go one or two ways. Like, like I played with an interesting guy at Billions. He was eating a Philly cheese steak, dipping snuff, and manspreading at a 10-handed table. Right? That was kind of interesting, but I don't want to do it again. So, yeah, it sounds like this is the good type of interesting.
No, it's both. I mean, I kind of enjoy that. Like, you got a good story out of that. Like, I wouldn't want to... Carlos just gave me the best one.
Like, okay, this guy's built like Santa Claus, and he's basically sitting in my lap. No. He dropped a piece of ice on the felt and just watched it melt. No, I don't want to do this.
It's not about one. You just
I still love him.
That's what I mean. You have to love him anyway.
I still love him. I just don't want to sit next to him ever again.
that's very understandable. But I mean that's like the appeal of poker, is it attracts all these just like crazy people, and like some of them are crazy in sort of like antisocial way. Many of them in kind of antisocial ways. And, like, part of the appeal of poker is that There's other places where they don't fit in so well, and you just have to enjoy them for the collection of, like, sometimes unpleasant freaks that they are.
I guess.
Are you 86th from Harris Properties? No? Come on in. Your money is good here.
Right. Right.
Yeah. And, like, all this other sort of sometimes annoying stuff is fun to me just because I've been away from it for so long. But, like, yeah. Playing this tournament and, like, the guy who lost half his stack 2 hours ago wanting to, like, rehash the hand is like, oh, man, what if I, like, re-raise before the... No, I still go broke. It's like, well, what if I call, then somebody else calls, then that person bets after the flop, then I could have folded, then I could have... No, I could have bluffed. No, fuck, no. No, yeah, God, I had a pat nine. I just had a pat nine. I had a pat nine. It's like, dude, you had a pat nine. It's like you're playing No Limit Deuce. Like, it's like, it's not easy to make a pat nine.
Yeah. That's funny.
Yeah.
We had one in my brief time in the Colossus yesterday where it was like, queens opens, kings re-raises from the small blinds, they get it in, and then the flop is like, or the board runs out like, deuce, 3, 7, 7, and with spades. And the big blind is like, it's a good thing you re-raised. I definitely would have busted you. I was like, yeah, he re-raised kings out of the small blind. Not really a controversial move. He's like, that's a good re-raise. I would have busted you. I would have busted you for sure. I was like, he might not have gone bust on a 2-pair, 3-flush board.
Yeah, maybe not.
If he, for some reason, flatted with kings in the small blind.
Yeah, people are just really excited. I liked your tweet where, like, the floor announce is like, dealers, please hold up after the scam to the next hand.
The guy's like, hand for hand. It's hand. It's probably hand for hand. He had it all figured out.
Yeah.
It's great, though. It's part of the majesty of it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, when I put that stuff on Twitter, it's sort of like 20% mocking and 80% appreciating is sort of the ratio that I like to think that I'm hitting.
Yeah, it's like...
I don't mind that kind of stuff also. Like, I just... Like, the weird stuff that happens at a poker table that I'm an observer in, I enjoy. But when I become a participant, that's when I don't like it. Like, if this guy was, like, just one seat over, I would have been fine. But when he's right next to me and, like, you know, his Santa Claus leg is on my leg, it's not good. And, I mean, just the 10-handed table is tough anyway.
Yeah.
But, But observing that stuff, especially through your Twitter account, is enjoyable.
And Nate's had a great... Your tweets from the Dealer's Choice were excellent for what I like about having you in Las Vegas, which is I just feel like you have an appreciation of cards and gambling that exceeds even mine. And you know, Carlos can be like over it pretty quickly. But you're just sort of... You put me in the right mindset, and your joy at playing Dealer's Choice was peak Mavis.
It was a really fun
peak
tournament.
Peak Mavis in Vegas.
Yeah, yes. It was a really fun tournament. And again, if you don't want somebody saying, like, oh, what card game he's playing that orbit in level 3, you know, just block me. I don't care.
Yeah.
just block.
Who doesn't enjoy that? Who doesn't want to see shots of those little... Because I've never played one of those. Like, I've played a few mixed game, like, cash games, but, you know, just... That's, like
an 20 interesting... 20 like, that's a lot of play. You have to, like, I literally couldn't find it. I had to call the game and then, like, play with one hand while I was, like, finding the damn plaque with the other hand. Yeah, it's very fun. Very fun.
Yeah, Nate's Twitter feed is like one of those, you know, the little flip books we made as a kid. We just flip through them like there's so many pictures if you scroll through it fast. Yeah. It's almost like watching like the action at the table.
Yeah. I'm trying to get better about doing pictures because you've made me like my tweets have mostly been text based.
Yeah.
And part of it is I don't like taking pictures of people without like getting very explicit consent from them. But I think, you know, you're very good at incorporating your pictures in ways where I'm like, oh, I should probably my Twitter feed would probably be a little more compelling if I got some pictures in there.
Yeah, and it's... I don't know. It's good. It's good. It also, like, lets me play games that I haven't played for money since 2007. But it's fine because my opponents tend not to have either.
What were your go-to choices? I mean, first off, what did you go in thinking were going to be your go-to choices?
So I went in thinking that, you know, so Barry Greenstein, Ace on the River, one of the most underrated poker books ever. He says players make a mistake of choosing their best games for, like... And this is in the context of negotiating what a mixed game is going to be, what games are in the mix. They make the mistake of worrying about their own strengths instead of their opponent's weaknesses, which matters like much, much more to your bottom line. sitting next to Carlos, he's nodding sagely. That's a man who knows that lesson.
I'm nodding because I think that also applies to just regular No Limit Hold'em in game. People focus more on their strength than their opponent's weaknesses. Yes.
Yeah. But so there's that. But also, I think people make a huge mistake. So I was playing with big stacks to my left and short stacks to my right. And you know, it's a pretty stupid thing to call in that situation. Any big bet game. And so, like, if you think about, do big bet games favor you right now? And second, do you want variance right now? Do your opponents want variance right now? The answer will suggest itself pretty fast. And then there's also, like, how good am I at the game? So in Bidusi and Bidasi, those are two games where I'm giving a lot up to, like, the people who actually play mixed games every day. Because those games have been in a lot of the Vegas mixes over the last 5 years. And I've played, I don't know, like 20 hours of those games, and which is absolutely nothing compared to what everybody else has. So those are games where, like, even if I thought that formally they were the right choice, I would probably try to find something else, especially with, like, Randy Ohel and some grindy type on my left. But for the most part, I'm trying to choose based on what's the right choice for, like, you know, for the stacks, for how much variance right. I need. And things like that. And I think if you go in with that mindset, that was my sort of biggest reciprocal edge probably in the tournament, except when there were some weak spots at the table. Like, you know, if somebody's playing way too many hands, that's an even bigger source of reciprocal edge. But so my go-to games, so PLO8 is a good one if I need a big bet game. Although a lot of people like Big O, so I think more and more people have spent time thinking about pot limit, split pot, Omaha games. So there's that. Like Hilo Regular, Stud Hilo Regular. It's a low variance game where weak players just get... I mean, it's... Like, the reason you don't see it is because weak players don't stand a chance. Like, they just get... Like, they don't win. They get zero, a half, zero, 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 a half. Like, it's just like yeah. Nobody, I don't know how, they, like, the game just doesn't work. Like, it's just like just bad players just give their money immediately to players who know what's up.
Yeah, that doesn't seem like it's good for the ecosystem.
No, it doesn't. It's not very sustainable. So there's that, and there was once when, like, 7-card stud, there was a guy to my right who was kind of going off a little bit and specifically making bad choices about continuing after 3rd Street but before the river in stud games, and I actually think a lot of people haven't played a lot of straight 7-card stud.
I know I haven't.
Yeah, so that's a game that I thought, you know, I've played, you know, quite a bit at least. It also has the extra betting round where if I think that it's, you know, people are going to make bad decisions, they're going to do it for an extra big bet round. That's good. I thought that the positions favored me also. And that was before a really good stud expert showed up. So I thought that was a game. It's definitely not, it's not one of my best three games. But for the situation, I thought it was a good thing to have in my arsenal. So that's that.
Were there games you were looking forward to playing just aside from any strategic reason, just like, oh, I haven't played that game much, or I like that game?
I mean, it's kind of cool. Like, my dad played 5-card draw, and, like, playing 5-card draw, no limit, but for a lot of money, is pretty cool. Like, I played that once in my life for serious money. It was at the Wynn, randomly a 5-10 5-card draw game broke out. And this was, like, funny because I went and posted about some of the hands in the other poker forum on 2+2. And everybody started by saying, like, oh, well, you must be much better than me because this hand is, like, much higher stakes than I would play. Well, this was, like Mark Gritter and people who really know other games. Like, no, like, you don't, like, there's just a bunch of fucking yahoos at the Wynn who, like, start playing draw one day. Like, we don't know, like what do you think this, like...
That was my attitude in 2007, too. I was just like, oh, you're playing for a lot of money. You must be really good. And, like, looking back now on what, like, the 5-10 No Limit games on Party Poker looked like in 2007, I feel like an idiot for not playing them.
Yeah.
At the time, I was just like, oh, my God, they're playing for $1,000.
Yeah. Speaking of games in 2007, like, this guy showed up at my table, and I was like, oh, who is this guy? And I could sort of tell he'd been, like, he was clearly somebody who had been in the poker world for a long time. But, like, I didn't really know who he was, and it turned out to be Chufty. I was like, ah, I'm playing with Chufty. Yeah, anyway.
I was hoping that was going to be MLG.
No, it was not MLG. That would be great.
I was hoping it was going to be somebody I know. It was Tufty.
Somebody who, I mean, maybe you...
No, I don't know. Richard Ashby is his real name.
Yeah, he was just he just played a lot of the big games back in the day, and I don't know, he showed up a lot, and he was just... He's just like a guy, you know, like when Hollingall was like
Andrew and I a couple of days ago, you know, had a conversation reminiscing about the old 2+2 screen names, and I think your knowledge of this goes way deeper than probably either of ours, and so like that's the second name you mentioned I never heard of.
Oh, I mean, so Hollingall was like a. Like, if you followed what was going on the biggest games on PokerStars in 2006 or whatever, like, he was playing the biggest... He was 4-6 tabling the biggest no-limit games on all the sites every night in, you know, in 2005. So, I mean...
I think at that time I was still on... I started with Party Poker.
Yeah.
And, like, PokerStars was, like... That didn't even exist to me until probably 2006.
Yeah.
And when I came on, I was just basically engulfed in the small stakes sit-and-go world. So I didn't even venture to other games, and definitely not higher stakes.
Yeah.
Because, again, I felt like that stuff was just, like, way beyond me. So the regs during that time at those stakes, I have no knowledge of whatsoever.
Sure.
But it's cool to, like, reminisce about old school 2+2.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a good time. Buzz, the Omaha guy, he passed away, right?
That sounds familiar.
Yeah. Rip Buzz. I was thinking about him. And also Felicia Lee, just randomly like playing all these other games. It's like, oh yeah, Felicia Lee. Rest in peace.
That's a dude?
No, it was...
Felicia.
Felicia was a woman.
Okay.
But Buzz and Felicia Lee, yeah.
Gotcha.
Two people I was thinking about yesterday playing other games. May they both rest in peace.
Yeah.
So I fired the Colossus twice, went over to Venetian, played one Venetian bullet, busted it, kind of almost, basically max late registered Venetian, which is a little better than Colossus. I got like 25 big blinds on that, and actually mostly because I wanted to take today off. Like if I had been planning on playing today, anyway, I probably would have just gone home and played today. But I did end up making it through on that. I have close to an average stack coming back to day two, which is nice.
Yeah.
But I was thinking of Carlos's... Like, I was just sort of imagining Carlos smugly looking at some of my tables when I have, like, Scott Baumstein and Andrew Lichtenberger at one table, and then, like, Shannon Shore and, like, a few other pretty good players from New Jersey.
Yeah, Carlos is crushing fools at $5 tournaments on Lovada. Sort of
just like, imagining Carlos like... Well, I'm not playing that tournament. No.
Yeah. Over here with my graham crackers and my $5 tournament. Like,
yeah. So, actually, I won a satellite seat on WSOP.com last night.
Nice
when
work.
I was, thank you. So, there were no good players. let's just say that.
Yeah. But how's that morning of day two buzz treating you now, Andrew?
It's nice. It does feel good to sort of to get today off. Because, like, definitely the worst case scenario, and I probably would have just taken today off anyway, I wouldn't have been happy about it, would be playing until, like, you know, midnight, and then, you know, bubbling day two or whatever, and then being like, oh, do I fire again, or do I take the day off anyway, or I probably would have ended up taking it off anyway, but it's nice just not be able to worry about it and get the day off that I wanted, knowing that I'll have chips.
Oh, this is that $3.5 million tournament.
Yeah,
the day two is tomorrow, right?
No, day two is Thursday.
Oh.
So that's the thing, there's several more flights.
That's right, this is that big one.
Yeah.
Oh, sweet.
It's a $3 million guarantee.
Yeah, $3.5 million maybe. Right?
Yeah.
Nice.
That explains why Lucky Chew is there.
Right.
That makes sense. Yeah, but also, like, if the guarantee is that big, it's going to draw out the riffraff also. Like, right?
Yeah. I mean, essentially what you're doing when you play it, because you're right, Carlos, there are a lot of good players who are drawn to those. Essentially, though, I mean, it's kind of like what we were talking about with the Colossus. Essentially, the way I'm looking at it is it's sort of like a series of very soft satellites to what will eventually be a relatively tough, like, 50K.
Gotcha.
Right? Like the final few tables of the tournament, I expect will have a fair number of good players at them, but you're almost, like, free-rolling it because of the amount of equity that you're getting from all of the poor players who are playing the earlier.
Yeah.
I mean, you say it like it's trivial to get through all these bad players.
No, it's not. I just mean EV wise. Like, of course you bust a lot.
Free rolling.
I'm just saying, like, you're buy-in. You're sort of like free rolling a tough couple of final tables.
Gotcha.
by you're getting subsidized, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because like, there's a lot of people who are attracted to big guarantees, not only pro. Like, that's, you know, the big guarantee attracts a lot of gamblers who want to potentially win $1 million, or not a million, but you know, potentially win a couple hundred thousand dollars for 1,100, and then that attracts the better players who are like, oh, there's going to be a bunch of bad players like firing, trying to win, you know, a big prize.
I understand that this is a situation where you take the good with the bad. And what I'm saying is that I think it's possible to just take the good. It's possible to just take the good. Like, this tournament sounds great, but it would be a lot better if Lucky Chewy was not there. So you can find similar things just for a smaller guarantee that don't have people like Lucky Chewy in it.
Yeah, that's fair.
And I am I'm late regging the Big Blind Nancy tournament.
Have you played with Big Blind Nancy before?
No.
Yes,
I mean, not in a tournament.
So great. So
not
great.
A tournament.
You played it in a cash game?
Yeah, briefly. Button ante. That's yeah.
Yeah.
It's good.
I only did it once, but I liked it. And I'm already feeling, especially with, like, you know, you get a lot of inexperienced dealers and players out here during the WSOP, and it really makes you just be like, why are we not doing a big blind ante? Which I think we will be by next
time. I think so. Even, like, everybody from, like, there's nobody who says, this is actually terrible for me. There are some people, like, there are things to work out at the final table. Some people don't like extra antes. Like, at the end, that's, like, a different issue that we'll have to think about. But, like, everybody loves the Big Blind Ante.
Why is Big Blind Ante more of a thing than Button Ante?
One person anteing. I think I like Button Ante better, but, like, I don't think it makes much of a difference.
The major argument for it is it's possible to have a dead button, and you never have a dead Big Blind.
Yeah, and they do it at Binion's, and the rule is if you have a dead button, then there's just no ante for one hand. Mm. And I think that's fine. It matters a lot in situations where like the satellite I play, the survivor I played, for example, is like you kind of got to take thinner shove spots because that you got to get hit with everything at once, and you also I don't know how to I guess I shouldn't have to adjust for it. Let me think about that. As far as like calling, like I know because it's a satellite, I know I can't call shoves very wide. And so I can't like, I guess that's the end of that sentence. I can't call shoves very wide, but I also know that, so like, let's say I'm under the gun or like one or two hands from under the gun with a short stack in a survivor tournament with a big blind ante. I'm going to be shoving wider in those spots because I know if I get hit by that big blind and somebody shoves on me, I probably can't call.
Right.
And so I felt it a lot more in that tournament. And I think if we did a button ante instead, that would have kind of like alleviated that under the gun pressure of being, I guess that's the other reason they call it under the gun. I made a tweet earlier in the summer that they call this position under the gun because players think if you don't limp a race from here, somebody's going to put a bullet in the back of your head. But yeah, to me, button lanty just seems like a lot more, it's just better.
One thing that just occurred to me while you were saying that is that the single player ante, however you do it, mm-hmm. tends to be smaller than if everyone's anteing. Like, it's often just the same as the size of the big blind, whereas when everyone antes, you often end up with like 1.5 big blinds in antes. At least, yeah. Like, sometimes there's large ante levels. So, like, the net amount of antes is often smaller in a single player ante structure. Is that?
Yeah.
Right. It looked like you were going to disagree with that. So if people are making, like, so if you're playing with not very sophisticated opponents who are already making shoving mistakes in satellites,
mm-hmm.
they're probably also not accounting for like the size of the antes when they're considering their shoves, and right. so their shoves are going to end up being even larger mistakes because the potential win is lower with you know, there being less in antes.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Can I pick up on one thing you said?
Please.
With some of the dealers who are not great?
Uh-huh.
The 20 game dealer's choice yesterday. Like, usually one reason to like those events is that they put the best dealers there. Yesterday the best dealers were not there. And like, I don't blame the dealers themselves. About 85% of them are doing their best. But, I don't think we should treat it as a fact of nature that there are a lot of bad dealers at the World Series. Like, I think we shouldn't abuse dealers, of course. And I think, like, there's a lot we can do to, like, work with them constructively, and that should be our priority. But I also think, like, somewhere along the line, we started just giving the World Series a pass for not having good dealers. And, like, it's like, oh, wow, nothing they can do about that. A lot of people... Well, first, when, like, it shouldn't be that hard to find, like, literally 20, 25 dealers who can deal all the games for, like, these smaller tournaments. And, like, second, they would have better dealers if they paid them a little bit more. And I know they've got to, like, make the bottom line. You can't just, like, magically find new money for everything. But, like, it is not just, like... An immutable fact that there are going to be all these shitty dealers here. Yeah. Like,
yeah. I mean, 20 games is a lot.
It is 20, but like...
A lot of them are the same. Like, dealing 7-card stud and dealing Raz is not really, like, meaningfully different, right?
I guess you have to know more things, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, there's... But, like, the players... Like, it's easier for a player to catch, like, oh, that's not actually where the bring-in is. Or,
and also, like, if you're pitching... Like, and especially with a sophisticated field... If you pitch the cards, the dealers will, or if you, the players will run a lot of it. Like, if you don't know, like, does a pair of aces or a pair of fours go first? Like, if you don't know, you can ask the players, they'll tell you, and that's, like, it's okay.
Yeah.
I have no idea what the hell that means.
So in Raz, the low board goes first. So, like, so if I have, like, 7-5-3 up, and you have 6-4 deuce up, your cards are better, but you're out of position. And then if you catch a king and I catch a queen, then I've got a queen low to your king low, so all of a sudden I'm out of position, so I have to check or bet first, and then you bet.
If there's no button.
Yeah, there's no button. Yeah, so it's yeah. But then, like, but like a pair of aces is, like, lower than the pair of aces goes for, but, like, you know, so if you think a pair of aces is high all the time and you say, oh, pair of fours, you know, the players will just say, no, the pair of aces is lower, and then you keep going, and it's not great, but who cares? Like, if you're pitching the cards properly, like, whatever, you're not, like, dealing a fucking flop. Looking at you, half the dealers from yesterday. And I mean, and again, big fan of dealers, really like the dealers. And, like, it was late at night, whatever. Like, I really get it. This isn't about ragging on people. This isn't about being a nit. Do not abuse dealers. Do not abuse dealers ever, ever, ever. However, like, you know, it's not a brute fact. And we could have good dealers. I mean, if it were a priority. And we used to complain about it as a community, and now we don't. Which is very strange, or at least, like, less, like, out of everything, like, it's like, yeah, I don't know, it just fell off the radar.
right.
I saw a kind of interesting thing yesterday at the Venetian. We had a dealer who, he wasn't bad in the sense of making a lot of mistakes, but he was very, very slow, both very slow in pitching the cards, and, you know, like, I got to the point where we were, like, taking over counting stacks in all different situations, because he was just so slow about it. And there was this one kid in particular who was really, he's kept being like, oh, we're getting, like, 5 hands an hour, like, he was really talking about it a lot. And then at some point, there's, like, an all-in pre-flop, and the last player to act in the big blind is this kid has been complaining about the pace of the game, and you're just, like, sitting there not acting, he doesn't really seem to be thinking, but is like, I'm like, what is he stalling for? And then I realized the push is coming, and he's waiting for the next dealer to push in before he folds, so that this dealer won't deal us another hand.
Oh, wow.
I was like, oh, that's clever.
Yeah. That's pretty good. That's some next level.
I would not think to do that.
Yeah, I don't, like, in time games, when I'm getting ready to quit, I have an awareness of when the push is coming, because I try to time it. Like, I just figure out how I can maximize, like, quitting close to my big blind while also, you know, avoiding paying.
Fading the time charge. Yeah.
Right. But other than that, like, I'm not usually too conscious of when the push is coming.
Yeah. That's pretty sharp. Yeah, and I do think, like, if you don't, like, yell and scream to a floor person, like, my MO, which I, you know, happened not to do yesterday, but, like, if you just, like, find somebody who's not in the middle of doing 6 other things and say, like, hey, you know, X, Y, and Z did a great job, but we've had some issues with people rolling the deck, you know, like, they will, in fact, like, the message does get out, and the floor people do care, and if you don't yell and scream at them, like, it is something where you can say, like, hey, there's an issue with the dealers today, like, you know, and, like, can I just say that? And, like, especially if it's clear that, like, you're actually not harassing them when they're doing other things. Like, if you catch them in a down moment, and if you, like, you know, sort of temper it with some praise for other, you know, then, like, you can really, like, it really, like, has an effect. Like, these are people who can talk to each other. So,
yeah,
yeah. Like,
the Big Blind Nanti tournament that you're going to play today is, what, a 3-day? I mean, like, if you made the final table, you'd need to change your
travel. I'd need to fly back later, yeah, on the same day.
And what's your plan for tomorrow, other than day two of this Big Blind Nanti? Like, are you...
There are those donuts at Fix. yeah, Fix. There's donuts, and they come with two sauces, last I checked. There's a chocolate sauce, and also, like a butterscotch sauce, and the donuts are extremely fresh.
I've never heard of, like, dipping sauces for donuts.
Yeah,
I've
it's
never
amazing. Heard of that. It'll change your world. Change your world. It's not Nick Cash approved, but it's fantastic.
None of that matters when it comes to donuts.
Yeah. Don't let Matt Glassman hear this.
Yeah.
It's good. I'm going to take Carlos to Fix. We are playing day two.
Yeah.
We're going to talk some $5 Bovada tournament strategy over some $5 donuts. And that's going to be
So, but I guess you wouldn't be like taking the sort of flyer of like, oh, if I make day two, I'll change.
No, not like that. It's and there's like some other
daily
stuff.
Stacks.
Yeah, daily deep. There's a lot of. It's not hard to play poker. It's not hard to find poker right now.
Yeah,
there's a lot of poker. There's a 20 mix at the Rio that has some games that are interesting. So
a cash game.
Yeah. So that's good. Sometimes it's great. Sometimes it's merely okay. So there's that.
Often I'll have people, you know, students or otherwise, who will sort of ask, like, what do you think about the deep stacks? And I was like, oh, Nate likes those. That's always my answer to.
Yeah, I mean, I like late regging them. Like, I mean, if, like, take everybody in Las Vegas, most of the good players are doing other things. Then 1,000 people enter this $200 tournament, and it's done in 12 hours. And you can late reg it. Like, that money, it's like, are those good players? Like, some. Like, are many of them? No. No, they are not. Like,
didn't you say Alan Cunningham?
I was about to say that. Alan Cunningham won the first one of the year. I think it was a $250 buy-in. Yeah. So, I don't even think that is the big one. I can't remember what the buy-ins
were. Most of them are 200. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so.
I mean, there's you can do a lot worse. Like, as $200 tournaments go, like, there's, I think it's like 200 plus 35 or something, but like, the structure's, you know, fast. I mean, there's just a lot of money there. It's like, there's like $40,000 there, and there's not, you know, it comes from somewhere and you can win it. So,
right. I don't know if you guys remember this whole commercial. This might have been a Full Tilt commercial where it's like, Alan Cunningham, like, bragging about his bracelets, and then, like, I think there's Eric Seidel, like, he's like, oh yeah, I got 5 bracelets, and then Eric Seidel's at another table, and, like, you can't hear Alan over, like,
the jingling,
and Eric Seidel's, like, 10 bracelets or whatever it was at the time, and when he won this deep stack, I just imagine him with all 5 bracelets on, winning like a deep stack against these poor tourists that came in thinking that it was just gonna be like, oh, this is gonna be a cupcake field. Oh, there's Alan Cunningham.
Yeah.
But he's like not even quite, like, I don't think he has quite, so I think like a lot of tourists would be, if there was like Scotty Wynn.
They'd
be like, oh wow, I'm playing with Scotty Wynn, but like I don't know if Alan Cunningham has quite the same like wow factor.
Yeah, it's like, it's like well, this friendly local accountant has decided to play poker with us today. And I mean, I love Alan. Like, I played with him, super nice, brilliant player. Yeah, but like, it's not like he's not like a super distinctive. It's not like sitting out with Doyle or something where like just the image is gonna.
He doesn't attract attention to himself.
No,
yeah,
and he looks like an accountant.
As it reminds me, I overheard this dealer. I want to say Mark is his name. Fair enough. He's a you know, a dealer I see around here. I think he deals final tables, which is why he knew Raymer. But he's got a super strong New Jersey accent. I'm not going to really do it justice here, but it's, you know, he's dealing my table, and Raymer comes by and he's like, "Oh, you jinxed me, Mark." And he's like, "Greggy, you gave somebody a good story, Greggy. They got to say they busted the champ."
The Rio, man. There's no place like it.
That's true.
We better just leave it on red and retreat on the double.
Tournament Poker Edge is our strategy sponsor. Do you dream of playing the World Series of Poker or the World Championship of Online Poker or even just crushing your friends in your local home game? You can find strategy tips to take your game to the next level at tournamentpokeredge.com.
Taking a selfie.
Yeah, yeah, kind of. Yeah. Everyone knows what the back of that head.
That's the microphone. That's there. There we go. I gotta do something while Andrew's reading that.
Reading. That was off the top of my head.
Brilliantly improvising the ad. It's, yes. Excuse me.
Okay, better at that. If we go back a few years on my attempts to improvise off the top of my head.
Perhaps you would like to watch some videos. Well, let me tell you where you can watch some videos.
Any mixed game hands that come to mind immediately?
I posted some of them. So there's one that gets to a broader issue. And I did talk about it on Twitter, but I haven't elaborated upon it on Twitter. So it's 100-200 are the blinds. We're playing Big O. That's 5-card, pot limit, Omaha, 8 or better. So there is a qualifier on the low. 5 cards. I would say like a very pro seeming, and he kind of seems like a hold'em pro, but not somebody who's a fish in the other games. I don't know. Like, watch it be like friggin' some great player. But I mean, I'm sure like great mixed game player. But like, my sense was, and inferring from some of his plays, he was extremely smart, and he has experience in the mixed games, and he kind of just seemed, but they didn't call hold'em. I don't know. Whatever.
Maybe he was bored of hold'em and he wanted to play something else when he's playing a dealer.
Yeah, a young guy who, it seems to me, he's made a lot of money at poker. Whatever. He made it 600. I don't know. It's a dude.
So James Hubs raises to 600.
No, it's like, yeah, whatever. Yeah. Ray Deckargani calls the button, and he's calling with a good range because he's really good at poker. And he's not real tight. Sorry. Chufty calls the small blind. He is... I'll say that he's probably a little looser here than some other pros are from the small blind, from what I've seen. He's not one of these people who thinks that just because he's out of position, he shouldn't call a raise. Hey, he played good. He took a lot of my chips. I'm saying, you know, he's way up against me in lifetime. I don't mean that in a snarky way.
Right.
I'm also one of these people.
I think there's a little bit of snark there.
I didn't intend it that way. I was actually thinking it's sort of like the other way, or like... Like, think about 2+2, those old forum posts where, like, David Sklansky is advocating, like, folding, like, whatever. Like, ace-jack to a single raise from the small blind. Anyway, whatever. Yeah. So Chufty calls. Do not think that he's folding everything just because he's in the small blind. I'm in the big blind with ace, king, queen, queen, 4, 3 diamonds. And I've got... about 3,300 total. So 600 from the cutoff. Good player raises. Very good player calls. I mean, Chufty, very good player, calls the small blind. I've got almost exactly a pot-sized raise. A little, like, if I pot it, I'll have just almost nothing behind. I've also got ace, king, queen, queen, 4. Any sense of what you would do here?
I'm not really confident in my sense of what I would do, but I'll say one thing that I've kind of, because I've been playing a fair bit of, not a lot, but like, again, 20-ish hours is probably a reasonable number of like 5-card PLO, because they have a 5-card PLO game at National Harbor that I play sometimes. And one thing that I've thought about in terms of the differences between 5 and 4-card is that blockers matter less in 5-card because like it's so like there's still a decent chance someone has aces even though you have an ace in your hand. It's just like so many cards get dealt out. Similarly, like you have 2 jacks and jack 10 makes a straight, like, and there's, you know, 3 people have been p- putting in action on a Queen 9X board. Like, there's still a pretty good chance someone has Jack 10, despite two blockers in your hand.
Yeah, even
I
mean,
there's only one ace of diamonds in the deck, so like the flush blocker is a different story. But I think like the ace blocker is probably less of a big deal here than it would be if you had like ace queen queen four in regular.
I actually think my diamonds were king high. I think I had king queen four diamonds, and then ace queen or something else.
I mean, that said, it's still... I don't know how likely it is that you get multi-way action if you jam here.
Yeah.
So, like, getting it heads up and having 1,200 in dead money in the pot sounds pretty appealing to me.
Yeah, it's not bad. I think calling is a little bit better, maybe, than you think it is. And when I put it out on Twitter, some people actually advocated folding, which I think is... Wow. No bueno. But I also think that it gets to something that's also relevant in Hold'em, where I got a lot of comments like, what are you going to make? Like, are you going to make the nut low? Probably not. Are you going to make a set? Probably not. Are you going to make a Broadway? Probably not. Are you going to make a flush? You know, probably not. But, like, that's, like, a lot of things. And, like, and you get, like, the
I
same
thing. One of them.
Yeah. But, like, it's also, you know, you get this sometimes where, like, so he goes, like, raise call, and you're in the big blind with King 9 offsuit. It's like, like, what, are you going to hit a 9 and that's going to be good? Or, like, are you going to make 2 pair? Or, like, are you going to get, like, a bluffing spot? Like, oh, man, just fold on to the next hand. It's like, well, that's like a... Those are some things you just said. Like, and, like, they all, like, any one of them can happen. So, I think it's to a common... It's, I mean, you can sort of get into cognitive biases talk here, but I think it's... In some sense, it's representing the overall quality of the hand by, like, the specific things, by, like, a few specific outcomes that can happen. And on the one hand, in a big bet game, that's, like, a good thing to do. Like, if you're playing deep stacked with Hold'em, let's say, with ace four of clubs, like, a lot of the value of your hand is going to... Like, a lot of the EV of that decision is exactly what happens when you make a flush. Exactly. On the other hand, like, if I'm playing short stacked with just the big old pile of cards you get in this game, like, in some sense, you just, yeah, I got some equity, I don't know, like, I'm getting 5-1. I'm getting 5-1 on this call, and I've got, like, an ace, that's good. I've got, like, a lot of cards above a 10, that's good. So, I think folding is not good. I also think that if I pot it, like... So one thing that I was wrong about, this hand holds its value multi-way a little bit better than I thought it would. I just put it in against two top 15% hands, and it's actually, like, even.
So two dimes can do, like, five card?
Yeah, it can do five card, but yeah, it can do five card, yeah, Omaha high-low split. And you can just say, like, two top 15% hands, and then ace, king, queen, queen, four. And it actually, my hand is as good as theirs. So even if I get called in two spots, I am okay. I think that, given that it's a tournament, I think calling is a little bit better. Mm-hmm. For whatever it's worth, Brian Hastings and Ryan LaPlante, I think, both said to call. And those are some...
Good people to take advice
from. Yeah, so I feel pretty good about that.
Advice about how to play cards, anyway.
Yeah, I think potting is like...
That was not a dig at Ryan.
Right. I think potting is plus chip EV. You do not lose chips or even dollars by potting, but I think you may lose dollars relative to calling. Also, since, like, we're so short, position shouldn't hurt that much. So I just called and took a flop. Then it came queen 8-5 with some clubs, and I potted all in. And as you said, the original raiser had ace ace deuce with clubs. No, I mean, we chopped it up, but, like, it's even though I can see an ace, it turns out. Yeah, I mean, I was a little bit hopeful because there are only three aces other than the one I have, and, like, three people V-pipped.
It does help that you have that much V-pipping in a split pot game.
Yeah,
the aces should be.
Yeah,
like, someone was in there without an ace.
Somebody was in there without it, which, I mean, you know, like,
yeah, like, there, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Yeah, and I also think, like, so the original raiser was deep. I don't know the 5-card game very well. In the 4-card game, like, king, queen, jack, 10, king, queen, queen, 10. I guess I've got queens. Like, I've got a lot of those Broadway
that's
cards,
too. That's some of those other... That's why I mentioned low cards.
Yeah. I mean, like, 10, 10, 9, 9, 8 would be not good. But, like, there are some hands with high potential that don't have an ace in them that have good implied odds. So I don't know. I don't know what one or both of those. Yeah. It does remind me of I played a 12-game mix, and there's this guy, YZ. Is that his name? YZ. ZY. Anyway, whatever. Really good mixed game player. I guess he's, like, known as, like, a guy. And he, like, deliberated. And then, like, you could tell... Anyway, point being, there should not have been another ace in the deck, and it was clear that that was part of his deliberation, and then an ace hit the river, and he jumped out of his chair and said, in like, he doesn't have much English, like, "What the fuck?" it was like he doesn't, yeah, I mean, like, super nice guy, super deliberative, like, just like a consummate pro and brilliant, and like, he almost never took time, and he like really thought through this decision, and we were playing PLOA or whatever, and then like an ace hit the river, like, shut up. So yeah. Card removal, good source of humor.
Was this hand? Were the cards revealed at this point, or
so somebody had folded? Yeah, the cards were revealed. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's a
I'm having trouble following this conversation because I don't play these games. But in my mind, I'm thinking like, this is a situation where cards aren't shown yet, and he's just so good that he knows he got one out of it. Without seeing the other people's hands.
So I mean, we were playing PLO8, mm-hmm. and like, it was a spot. There are a lot of spots where basically every playable hand has an ace in it. Yeah. And I think there was maybe even like an extra player. So like, two people would have had to have gotten in without an ace.
Right.
In like a raised spot, like where it's just not like It's like one of these things where it's like the flop comes queen 4-4, and it's like a six-handed pot, and then like somebody bets and two people call, and then like. The turn of river come queen or something. It's like what the fuck, like they go with fours or whatever. Like, imagine like, yeah, they're like eight cards, then like all the queens and all the fours. So like, what the hell? Yeah, like,
that makes sense. Right? Yeah.
Like, so that's a hand, and the lesson is sometimes it just matters what your equity is, and sometimes it doesn't feel like your equity is what it actually is. But you should care about what your equity actually is, and not what it feels like. The end.
I had two slightly similar spots. You know, I think neither of these they're both like pretty straightforward decisions, mm-hmm. but I think they relate to this concept of like calling versus either shoving or folding from the big blind, which I know is something a lot of people are uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
When I talk about, I mean, I think it's become better accepted now, but like, I remember maybe 2 years ago when I started like putting videos on Turn of the Poker Edge where I'm calling wide from the big blind, people are like, "But what about playing after the flop?"
Yeah.
Like, yeah, you do that.
Yeah. Also, can I just like jump in? Like, I think this has changed a little bit, but especially on the more semi-serious amateur side, you get people saying like, "Oh, well, if I have 12 big blinds, and then if I call raise out of the big blind, and then let's say I check call two big blinds on the flop, then if I have to fold eight big blinds, what am I going to do with eight big blinds?" And the answer is like, you're going to get two cards, and you can fold the call or raise. You know, like you do, like you don't want to. It's really bad to lose a third of your stack, and it's really right not to bleed off chips. But also, if you're getting enough EV, and if calling is really a lot better than shoving, then hooray, like you're allowed to play eight big blinds. Like, you don't just, like, the TD does not come and just confiscate your last eight big blinds. Like,
I think that's how it feels to people, though.
Yeah.
Like, I think a lot of people just want to round down to zero.
It's, I mean, some people do have sort of their own tilt that functions like a TD that
that's
comes.
Right, that's what I mean.
Yeah. It's like, yeah.
This is tacky. I was going to quote myself on one of my favorite tweets, but I guess the gist of it is sort of like, you know, poker's a game of patience, and if you keep your head down and you wait long enough, eventually you get king six offsuit and you're under the gun with four big blinds.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's not really a joke. Like, it's funny, but it's true. Like, will get plus EV spots. Like, it's the idea that you have to, like, take a negative EV spot because you're getting shorter.
Yeah.
Like, you're waiting for something. Ideally, it's aces, but, like, if it's not aces, like, it just gets more and more EV to shove more hands. Eventually, you're going to find a plus EV shoving spot.
Yeah. Man, Buster's sick cooler. I had 4.8 big blinds of equity with King Sona, and I didn't get any of those 4.8 big blinds. Sick, man.
I mean, even if you don't get a plus EV shoving spot, eventually you'll get a plus EV calling spot
right
in the big blind.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just like you keep folding until a plus EV spot presents itself, and like, yeah, the shorter you are, the more of those there are. But so this was actually the very first hand of my second bullet in the, or no, my first bullet in the class list yesterday.
Yeah.
We're at the 100, 200 level, we start with 5,000 chips.
Yeah.
I have Jack 10 suited in the big blind, and you have three pretty recreational looking players. The first one opens like under the gun plus three to 525.
Yeah.
Two calls, and it's on me in the big blind with Jack 10 of spades.
I would call. I mean, jamming. I mean, against the right opponent profile, jamming has merit, but hey, sometimes you take down a lot if you. I mean, I think I. You know anything about the callers?
That's literally my first hand at the table. Okay. They just, you know, they look recreated. You know, like they don't look like nits. I mean.
How many chips do they have?
A fair number, you know, probably like 8K and 12K or something.
Yeah.
And the original Razor had a lot. He had like 15. He had a lot.
I think it's pretty bad when you get called. And you get called, like, sometimes the original Razor has a really good hand. Sometimes the callers, like in this thing, like, if you get called by Ace 10, that's very bad. Obviously, I'm just making up a really bad scenario, so.
Yeah, because the thing is, like, it's not that bad when you get called by ace king, ace queen, nine. Like, so it's sort of like if they have wider calling ranges, with the exception of like ace 10, exactly, I guess, like king jack if they start, but I mean, for the most part, like widening their calling ranges, your equity gets better. If they don't have wider ranges, then you're just
calling is also like extremely good.
Yeah,
I mean, as you widen their call, I mean, if you think about standard calling ranges, it's going to be a lot of pairs and a lot of big ace hands. That's like the typical range, and then as you start to widen it, it's going to be hands that dominate you.
Yeah, I guess it's like how wide do you get? So like, you know, if
you're not getting called by like 8-7 suited. If you're getting called, it's going to be like that. I mean, that's true too. I think the ranges start to widen to hands like king jack or ace 10, and so as you widen the range, I think it's worse for you in this situation.
Yeah, if you get that wide, that's true.
Yeah.
I guess I'm more thinking if you get, I mean, I guess no one's really folding nines anyway. So
yeah, like, see, to me, that's like the normal.
No, you're right.
Yeah.
I guess that statement is just wrong. I mean, so I think like the callers, very rare, like the people who called that raise are very unlikely to be calling the shove. You know, like, not that you never see people flat, but I just think like people are splashing way too much.
I think that's right. Yeah. I think that's right. I think sometimes you get like, I don't know. Like, I'm saying this as somebody who, like I jammed my first hand, and I just got, like, a call by ace 8. Like, right. Yeah. I'm like, and sometimes that guy's just going to call, and then when it gets back to him, he's just going to call. Like, and that's that. But, like, also ace 8 is not that bad for
you. Right, yeah. I mean, that's, yeah. So, you know, like, the hands, like, I don't think they're going to have aces, kings, queens that they're flatting with. I don't think you see a lot of that.
Nah, not a whole lot, yeah.
So it's like, okay, jacks and tens are possible, and those are really bad. I guess, like, ace-jack is possible, and that's bad. But in terms of the callers, there's not a lot of worst-case scenarios.
That's that. Right.
Like, mostly they fold, and when they don't fold, you're mostly in okay shape against, if they do. I think, like, eights is pretty realistic for them. And then, so a lot of it just comes down to the original raiser, who also didn't seem, he wasn't all that attentive after he raised, which was something that I picked up from you, especially when we did that live thing in New York.
Yeah.
And you were talking about seeing, like, you know, someone has aces, and now they're, like, really intently watching the eye. Zach Elwin talks about this, too.
Yeah.
So I thought it was, like, a little less likely that he had some of the really nice pairs.
Now I kind
of
like jamming. I mean, calling is wonderful, but maybe jamming's even better.
The thing I don't love about calling is that I don't think you get a lot of fold equity after the flop, which you really want with this. Like, I mean, so like hitting a jack or a 10, you have a pretty good hand, but I mean, you have a very good hand for the stacks, but you know, a lot of times you're going to have your draws of some sort where you would like some fold equity.
Yeah.
And I think in a four-way pot, it's kind of hard to generate that. Like,
often, really? Like, your relative position is so good. I think it goes like check, check, and then, like, one of the last two takes a stab with whatever. Like,
but, like, there's 2,400.
Yeah.
Or, yeah, there's, like, 2,400 in the pot, maybe 2,500.
Yeah.
And I'm going to have
a low SPR,
46 back. So, there's, I mean, it's, if someone could even, like, accidentally commit themselves.
Well, that's the thing, but, like, I almost think it's kind of a sweet spot where people make like horrible folds. It's like if somebody bet folds, like a lot of times they're either going to bet and they're going to give away the strength of their hand by betting, or they're going to have no idea what's in the pot. It's like, I bet 1,000, you know, like, or like sometimes they bet fold, like they bet 2K, then you shove, then they fold because they decide they're behind.
Yeah,
they didn't come here to put in money with the worst hand.
Yes, they did.
And also, like, I know I'm just, again, just making things up that sound good, but like, there are really kind of a lot of flops like 9-7-3 where you check raise and it's not that easy to hit that flop hard, and there are a lot of, like, their stab fold range should be pretty, you know, a lot of their stabbing range will fold if they're not, where it's hard to be balanced. For a good player, and for somebody who is not thinking at all about that, like, a lot of their betting range is just like, I have ace jack, perhaps I can win the pot. Ooh, this gentleman appears to have made a hand. Yeah, it's just like, I don't know. Like,
frustrated fold.
Yeah, he's like, well, golly shucks. So I think calling is very good. I think it's almost a sweet spot for some of these situations, like letting them make big mistakes. But I don't know. Jamming is great. Right now, I think it's a jam as described, but also close. Yeah.
So, yeah, I went for the shove.
Yeah.
Maybe this is also related to just feeling gambling when you buy in with 25 big blinds, which was very much on the original Razor's radar, because he asked the dealer if I was a new player or if I was like a re-entry table transfer.
Yeah.
And I said, it's $49.75. He's like, that's not what I asked.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I don't know if that's like information you're entitled
to have. Yeah. But also, what is this man's social security number?
That was when something came in. So I was like, anyone need my mother's maiden name? And then after the hands over this guy on my right, he's like, you're Andrew. And I was like, that's a hell of a guess.
Yeah.
And he's like, you talk on internet sometimes. I do talk on the internet sometimes.
So
shout out to Uriel. He's not from Zimbabwe, but he currently lives in Zimbabwe, which was surprising. So shout out to Uriel in Zimbabwe.
Wait, somebody's listening to us in Zimbabwe?
Apparently.
Nice.
That is awesome.
But he didn't listen to our interview with the poker player from Zimbabwe.
Yeah, I know. It's like, we're probably for Zimbabwe coverage, we're way up there at Poker Podcasts. Especially like monetary policy. Is it Zimbabwe and monetary policy? We've discussed that more than any other poker podcast has.
Is it still called Zimbabwe?
I think so.
Okay.
What it used to be called? This is like
Rhodesia.
A standard. Yeah. That's a trivia. That's a quiz bowl thing. That's a former name. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So I have another Jack 10 in the big blind spot, also from the Colossus.
Very good.
This one, a European player.
I'm sorry, I gotta interrupt.
Yeah, please.
I think the capital is like Lilongwe or something. I can spell it, but I can't pronounce it.
Very good.
More useless trivia information. Okay, go ahead.
Mostly just based on a little bit of his demeanor, mostly the fact that he's like European and in his 20s, like probably a internet pro. I mean, there's some people who come over here, but I just think like European, especially like Russian in their 20s, he's pretty like good to be a pro.
Very briefly, like 8 years ago, I was playing at the Wynn, and there's this like 26-year-old like sort of Scandi dude, and he's like, you know, playing a lot of pots. And I was like, oh, it was kind of passive. I was like, yeah. It just turns out he was just like an extreme fish. So he's like, oh, you're out here for the summer? He's like, yes, I just want to see some shows. Like, it's like, what are the chances of that? He's just like going to Las Vegas, you know, just like hang out and wow, that was not what I was expecting.
Right.
So, point being, that requires a stroke of luck. Yeah, probably an internet pro.
So we're at 300, 600 with a 75 ante. And he's in the hijack, and he's got a stack of 8,000 to start the hand, and he opens to 2,000, and I have Jack 10 offsuit in the big blind.
Sorry, 400, 800?
3-6.
300, 600. Sorry, stack is 8,000.
His stack is 8,000.
Okay. 300, 600. He opens to 2,000 from the. And there's an ante. Is this his usual race size?
He had not been playing very many pots. He'd been short, so he'd just been sort of...
I would sci-fold. Like, if he is really good, then you probably have a call. If there's any chance he's just a little bit excited about having a good hand, then it gets pretty bad for you pretty quick, I think. I think formally it's probably a call. It's like a close call. I think jamming is pretty bad, given that there's like an X percent chance that our read is a little bit off, or he's just a little bit undisciplined and he's raising more with like some good hands that he's going to call with.
Yeah, I mean, so I would take jamming off the table.
Yeah, yeah, good. Yeah,
that's an option.
Yeah,
like, I doubt he folds after making it 2,000.
Yeah, and that, like, yeah, good. But you know, good. I think I would fold. Like against somebody who I know is like raising a lot, and 2,000 is a normal raise size, I think Jack 10 is just a good hand, and you have to call with it. I mean, still.
Well, but it's still like, it's a little weird that he's got 13 blinds in the hijack, not even 13 blinds in the hijack.
Yeah, and he's racing like three of them.
Yeah.
Three and a half, yeah.
And he's not shoving, and he's also not like, but it's not like an inducey raise either. Like, he could have made it 13, and, you know, like, if you wanted to be like an inducey thing with aces, I would expect that, not like 2,000. Because, like, it's pretty clear to me I don't have fallback with it. Doesn't
seem I would just fold. I mean, yeah. Carlos?
I will say this is something that I see online that, okay, so Andrew made a really good point here. So this guy is in a situation where most people would probably just shove. So he's choosing to deviate from that. So he's either deviating because he's bluffing a lot, or he's trying to induce action with a strong hand. It's usually one of those two things. Like, if this guy has deuces, he's probably just shoving.
Right.
And so you can kind of take, like, so a lot of the middling hands out of his range, and that leaves, by definition, a polarized range left. So if he's a tighter player that's going to be looking to, like, maybe he has, like, jacks or queens where he doesn't want to go post-flop, but he's willing to get it all in pre, so he's kind of, like, forcing you into that decision. Or he's one of these types that are, like, raise folding with, like, ace-deuce off or something. So if you can kind of tell if a guy is, like, generally a tighter player or a more bluffy player, then you can make better decisions in spots like this. It's tough to say because of the size and he made it, but generally what I'll do in these situations online, this hand actually came up when I was twitching recently. A guy did a similar thing, but instead of making it this big, he maybe made it like 2.5, and he was generally like really bluffy. So I like men 3-bet him with like 6-5 off, 6-5 suited, and he called and folded to like a 25% c-bet or something.
I feel so silly for even answering this question because you know so much more about this spot than I do. You're too modest to say, but like, watch this man's Twitch stream. You're so good at these small tournaments by now.
Thank you.
That's really smart.
I appreciate it.
I learned something.
And then the good thing about Bovada is that you can see the hands after the fact.
Yeah.
This guy, I think he had like 12 bigs or something, and he made it like 2.5 with 8-5 of spades. And so I like, he made it like 2.5.
As
I think
one does.
I made it like 5 with 6-5 suited. He called and folded on like a big flop to a small C bet. But generally these type of people, when people don't shove stacks, if they're nits, then they're probably just inducing aces. And if they're bluffers, they're probably bluffing. And so that's just like a simplistic way I look at it. The problem here is this guy's made it so much that you can't really like he's gonna be committed on so many flops if you raise here. And like, have you even, like, you probably didn't even consider like raising less than all
that.
But this is only an option if you have a HUD. And you can see that this guy's running like, you know, 29-27. But without having that live HUD going, I wouldn't risk it. I would probably just fold in a live tournament.
I called. I mean, pretty good price. Like, he can't be that. I mean, without, like, I definitely don't think there's room to say, like, he just has, like, aces and kings. Like, if we just sort of assume
Yeah,
no. He took his entire shoving range and makes it 2,000. Like, we took that as like a broad assumption. It was like, instead of shoving, he's just making it 2,000 with whatever he would shove. Jack 10's, and like, I want to call, like, I wouldn't call a shove with it, but I'd call for 1,400 more.
And
it's a hand that has good visibility on the flop, right? Like, you can pretty clearly tell, like, these are the flops where I have equity and these are the flops where I don't. Like, the equity breaks out in a better way than like ace 3 offsuit does.
That's right. I would, before I felt really confident about this, I'd want to play with like a tool to like really see, like, do I really know how good I am on a, you know, whatever, a queen.
One question for you: how many, and you maybe already said this and I just forgot, how many chips do you have?
I had about 20k,
so this is another 14. This is 3-6, yeah, so another 14 out of your stack. Okay, that makes calling better. I think as you get shorter, you want to like not invest bigger percentages of your stack. But here's the other thing. If you invest this much pre-flop, then I think you're supposed to fight harder for a post-flop. So you got to be willing to go with it on, like, I guess, less comfortable spots post. And does that seem accurate?
So, I mean, there's, if I call, there's going to be 43, like close to 5K in the pot, and he'll have 6K behind.
Yeah, so you're going to be pretty good anyway.
So, you know,
I'm going to
need like 38-ish% equity, something like that.
Yeah. Here's something that I'll do in these type of spots if I decide to call. I'll make like an absurd assumption here. Like, okay, when people make these big bet sizes, usually it's with a strong but vulnerable hand.
Right.
Something like maybe ace king off, ace jack, jacks, tens, hands like that. Given that we block jacks and tens, I may do like a fish play and put the guy on ace king and kind of like strongly depend on that read going post flop, which may be bad, but I definitely feel like we can't call here and then like fold post flop with any type of the board whatsoever. So if you're willing to go with it post flop, then
yeah, I mean, hands like middle pair, you know, gut shot with two, like
yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, I'm gonna put it in on those.
Okay, sure. Okay. And if we're going to do that, is that because right now we're talking about investing another 14, and that's not too bad for our stack. But if we think a good percentage of the time we're going to be investing the rest of what he has behind, that's a big hit to our stack. So we got to be, I think, pretty happy to do that, since we're basically committed. We're almost committing ourselves pre-flop. And so that's.
I mean, there's plenty of flops where I can fold too.
Like, I mean, commit it once we hit something.
Yeah. But I mean, that's an important distinction. Like,
yeah.
So you get to see a flop, and then you get to make it as like the flop. You can kind of think of the flop as like a new source of information about whether you're likely to have the best hand after seven cards come out.
Right.
And I think that I have a hand that benefits like more than many hands do from seeing the flop. Like, so the hand, like what he ends up having, which is ace-8. Ace-8 is not a hand that really benefits very much from seeing the flop. Like, ace-8 has a lot of equity even on flops that doesn't like hit in any particular way. Like, he could still easily have the best hand on a lot of boards in a way that like jack-10, you can sort of see, like, is there a jack on the board? Is there a 10 on the board? Do you have two overcards to the board?
Yeah.
Do you have a draw of some sort? You know, if not, and like, and also, like, is there an ace on the board? Is there a king on the board? That's really bad for your equity. So like, you can learn a lot about how good your hand is and then make decisions about whether to put the money in. Like, that's, I would look at that as an opportunity rather than like a liability of, oh, I'm going to be committed on some flops.
Right. And that's kind of what I was thinking in the last hand when Nate was talking about how good calling with the jack 10 suited is. But I think the difference here, this is a heads up pot as opposed to multi-way. So yeah, I can see calling here and just closing your eyes with like two overs in a gutter for like 80% of your stack.
That's like a third of my stack.
Oh, you had?
I had 20K.
And he's got 8?
He's got 6 behind. After the 2, it'll be another 6.
Okay, and this is something, I think I asked you this before. Like, sometimes when I'm making these decisions pre-flop, that I, like, I'm telling myself I'm calling 14 more pre, but if I touch any piece of this flop, I'm committed to the rest of it. So I will kind of look at the whole thing as like a 8K decision.
Even though then it's 40% of my stack.
Yeah.
It's not 80.
Did I say 80?
Yeah.
I meant 40. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I meant 40. I forgot the dividing stuff. Okay.
It's a good thing you don't teach math.
Yeah. Yeah. So it seems close to me, but I think you made good arguments for calling.
Yeah, I think it's a call.
So I called, and this was a flop where it was particularly easy to recognize that I had a lot of equity.
Yeah.
It was Jack 10 6.
I like your hand.
Yeah.
Now what do you do? He's got 6K behind, there's 5K in the pot.
You know the answer to this. I know the answer, so I'm not going to. Carlos, what do you got?
I'm checking every time, yeah.
So he ends up having ace 8. Mm-hmm. What do you expect him to do when you check?
Shove.
I think that's like.
Or at least bet.
And this, I mean, if he bets, like, what would be his reason for betting when he has ace 8?
Because he opened pre-flop. I think this is just
a difference in the caliber.
Yeah. Like, remind me which tournament this is.
Right. Yeah, it is the Colossus.
Okay.
But this particular player, I think, is like a 24-year-old Russian. Like, I think he's
okay.
Has like no.
That changes everything. You got to 3-bet this guy pre-flop. I'm just joking. Every time I'm hearing hand histories, I'm thinking about it in the context of Bovada tournaments.
Yeah, like
so I gotta be careful. Yeah, I gotta be careful against. Okay, so, So definitely against a good, I'm assuming aggressive thinking player, then I think you do have to call pre-flop. Otherwise, you're gonna get run over too much in this spot. he seems aggressive, and aggressive people like to bet, so I'm checking to him.
I think that this is not really like I don't know how likely he is to make betting mistakes. I also even wonder what he's going to do with like ace king or ace queen. I mean, he may just shove those and sort of take like the easy way out, but
yeah.
Honestly, like for my peeling from the big blind, right, like Jack 10 hits me pretty well. Like, there's probably not a lot that I'm like peeling from the big blind and then check folding.
Especially given the sizing he made it pre-flop, and he may know that.
That's an
interesting.
I
twist.
Mean, I guess maybe I sometimes have, but the six kind of connects with me. Like, I guess if I have like 6-5 suited, maybe you can push me off of that by jamming like king.
Maybe you don't call that versus the big size.
Right. That's right. I'm just trying to come up with like what hand could I have that would just be check folding this flop? Like, this is a flop where I'm gonna
A7 suited.
Yeah, I mean, that's not, when he has ace-king, he doesn't really care that much.
Yeah.
So it's like, how does he actually gain by betting hands like ace-king, ace-queen?
Sure. No, yeah. I agree. I think he played real well here.
Yeah.
What if you had king-queen or queen-nine, what would you do?
If I had king-queen or king-nine, I wouldn't have king nine. Wouldn't call that preflop. I guess suited.
Queen nine suited. King nine suited. King nine.
I guess with those type of hands, you probably want to just shove. And because how much is what's in the middle now?
It's 5K in the middle.
He's got six behind. If you want to just have like a. Almost like a 100% shoving range. I guess if you're going to play a lot of hands similar to this one, on this flop, you're going to have a lot of, like, good draws. And so you kind of want to, like, maximize your fold equity with those. And if you're going to do that, then you got to protect it with hands like this also. So, yeah. I think... if you want to construct your whole strategy that way, then it makes sense to just like shove this hand.
Yeah, I mean, I'm essentially thinking, like, so he's got a lot of hands that are going to be trivial stack offs, right? Like, if he has king, queen, it doesn't really matter what I do. You know, like, ace, king, ace, queen.
Yeah.
It's not inconceivable that those, like, check behind the flop, and then I guess I could just jam the turn, or if I bet small, then he can, like, peel the turn and potentially fold the river. Like, I don't think it's necessarily an auto stack against ace, king, or ace, queen if he knows what he's doing with a short stack.
Right.
A king queen, I think it's a little easier just because he has some incentive to jam king queen on the flop to get me to fold like a7.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so I definitely don't want him taking free cards with those. Maybe he has like 9-8 or something. I mean, I would think he would probably jam the flop, but like there's some chance he jar, or like even weaker than that, like 8-6, where he like just checks back and takes a free card. Like, I think better players are not just gonna auto bet the flop. And in terms of, like, how do I get him to put money into the pot with a hand like what he ended up having, ace-8, I think that strikes me as a hand that's not very likely to bet the flop. You know, he really doesn't want to get check-raised by whatever I might check-raise him with. Even, getting check-raised by a jack or a 10 kind of sucks for him with ace-8. Like, he'd much rather just check back and force me to play the next street. So, but I think it's also kind of hard for him to fold those hands when he's getting, you know, he only needs like 35% equity or whatever to call, and there's so many draws, including, like, he may assume that I wouldn't jam a hand like jack 10, which is what I ended up doing.
Right.
He might think that I'm only jamming draws, which I think is, in fact, how
that's a read that I would make
play the spot.
Yeah.
Which is all the more reason for him to peel with a hand like ace-8. So, you know, he did sort of like tank for a little bit and call with ace-8. And I think, this particular analysis is built around him having this particular hand, but
right.
I mean, I think he has hands that look like that a fair bit. Or, I mean, also he could have like pocket eights, and you know, he's not betting the flop with pocket eights for sure.
That's a good
and
point.
It's a very good chance he ends up folding by the river if he checks back the flop. But when he faces a jam on the flop, I mean, if I'm jamming a balanced range, I don't think he can call with eights. But if he makes the assumption that I'm, you know, overly bluff heavy, then I think there's a good chance he will call with eights at that price.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's mainly just the difference of, like, playing with a higher caliber player who's not just going to be like, well, I raised pre-flop, I'll bet the flop.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a continuation bet.
I've been studying poker. Daniel Harrington.
Yeah. Again, not to make fun. I know, it's just, there's something beautiful about seeing all these attitudes. Like, another one of you were talking about this is, like, you get the hand history, it's like, full surrounded me on the button. I see king, queen. I know I have the best hand, but I don't want to let it be out. It's like, yeah, you probably do, but, you know, no is a strong word to use there.
Okay, yeah. So, you shove and he calls. Yeah, so that's pretty much, what you do, ace-jack, you play the same way pretty much?
I think so,
yeah. Okay. Yeah, I do really like the idea of trying to take advantage of this almost universal read that when people shove in that spot, they often have a draw. And just taking advantage, I don't even know if taking advantage is the word, because just like using deception well by having bluffs and value hands there. That's something that the vast majority of the people I play against at least do not do.
Which, I mean, in some sense, they're just kind of taking advantage. Like you're saying, I mean, if your opponents really are just going to be sort of oblivious and they're going to, you know, just bet because they check preflop, then you want to give them a chance to do that. It's just when you have an opponent who's not going to make that mistake, then you kind of benefit by, like, denying him equity, denying him the opportunity to pot control.
You wouldn't jam ace jack before the flop?
I probably would, yeah. Yeah,
Queen. Yeah, or whatever.
Yeah, I think I would stick it in there. Anything else to talk about? I see Nate is eager to go back. Yeah, we've delayed you for an hour and a half already.
This is pretty good. This is pretty great. I really miss this. You guys came all the way over to the Gold Coast. I appreciate that.
We were saying it's nice to be back in the Gold Coast.
It's wonderful.
This is like the official hotel of the 2+2, or the 2+2 of the Thinking Poker Podcast.
That's true.
Two plus two. Those guys, you think Mason Malmo stays in the Gold Coast? He's got way too much money for that, I think.
Like you said, what's the point of entering a big blind ante tournament before there's an ante?
Thank you both, and
yes,
biggest thanks to my wife for doing everything back on the home front for a few days so I can come do this.
Yeah. For allowing us to borrow Nate for a couple of days.
Nah. You guys are great. Thank you for listening, everyone, and have a great summer.
Ocean of a Carmelite, the fair passage of a bill, and who will sign us into law?
Crunch, crunch, crunch. Teeth are strong and sharp. Crunch, crunch, crunch. Teeth can help you chew. But teeth are not for biting. Ouch! Biting hurts. How many teeth do you have? You can count them now. Someday you will have 20. Wow, that's a lot.